What's going on, baseball fans? Welcome to the On the Bump podcast, where two current major league pitchers take a deep dive into an all-time great pitcher of the past. We're shaking it up a little bit. We're going to do something different. Usually we have a pitcher on the pod, but today we have a guest that's possibly even more qualified to talk baseball than a current big leaguer, and that's ESPN writer and author of The Arm, Jeff Passan. Jeff is certainly a wealth of baseball knowledge. He's a blast to talk to. He knows his stuff when it comes to pitching, pitching history, and especially pitchers from the past. Jeff typically spends his time breaking big news on Twitter, writing some awesome articles for ESPN. I'm sure you guys have read a bunch of his stuff. I always walk away from our conversations with a big smile on my face because he's just so passionate about baseball. He's always in a good mood. He's a fun guy to talk to. You guys are really going to love what he brings to this episode today. Jeff and I are going to throw it way back to the 1930s. We're going to be talking about Bob Feller. I personally didn't know squat about Feller until Jeff personally requested we talk about him. And after my research, it's easy to see why. This is going to be a really fun episode. We're throwing it back almost 100 years to a time when the game was much different than what you guys see on the field today. And as always, I got to start with a little background on Bob Feller, and then I'll bring in Jeff Passan. So Feller grew up in Iowa, and by all accounts, had a very strict dad who was kind of hell-bent on making him a big leaguer. By the age of 9, I guess Bob could throw 270 feet. That's a long way. I mean, that's about as long as I go in my long toss program. So for a 9-year-old to be doing that, that's impressive. I guess the movie Field of Dreams basically took their plot from Bob Feller's dad because he's a farmer in Iowa, and in 1931, he kills a bunch of his crops to build a field in order to better prepare his son and showcase his talents to scouts. Well, it works because at 17 years old, the Cleveland Indians come in and they sign Bob Feller to a contract, and he would go on to spend his entire career with the Indians. So at 17 years old, he signs. And he debuts that year in 1936. He strikes out 17 batters in a September game. He's one of only two players ever to strike out the same number of batters in a game as his age. The other one is Kerry Wood's famous 20 strikeout game. As always, when you talk about pitchers from this era, you got to get into the bulk stats, seeing things like 300 innings, 45 starts, the amount of complete games that these guys work through. As someone that pitches in modern baseball, when I see these stats, they just blow my mind more and more every time. We covered Warren Spahn with Alex Wood on this podcast, who had the longevity, you know, who pitched for 20-something years, 363 wins, an incredible pitcher, Warren Spahn was. And Bob Feller, right there, 7 or 8 seasons, has as impressive of bulk numbers as we've seen from anyone in the history of our game. So let's get into a little bit of that. Peak years, so I'm talking 1939 to 1941. That's 3 seasons. Bob Feller led the league in wins all 3 years. He led the league in innings pitched all 3 years through 320, 343, and 296. That is an insane workload. He led the league in complete games 2 of those years, led the league in strikeouts all 3 years. He was the first pitcher and only one still to throw a no-hitter on opening day, did it in 1940. World War II comes around. I guess he's literally driving to start the season in 1942, and he hears that Pearl Harbor was attacked. The very next day, he enlists in the Navy. He gets assigned to the battleship Alabama, fights in some big battles, including the Battle of the Philippines, and, quote, says, "The most exciting 13 hours of my life. After that, the dangers of Yankee Stadium seem trivial." I imagine so. Fighting in World War II probably makes walking into Yankee Stadium to face Joe DiMaggio and those guys maybe a little bit easier. So all told, he accumulates 8 battle stars and served 44 months. 1 week after VJ Day, which is when Japan surrendered, Feller receives his honorable discharge. 3 days after that, he throws a complete game in Major League Baseball, strikes out 12 batters, gets the W. 3 days after being discharged from the Navy and fighting in World War II. So these are now years 1945 to 1948, when Bob Feller is very much still in his prime. At those years, he leads the league in strikeouts 3 times. He threw 371 innings one time. That's the most he would do in his career in 1 year. Led the league in starts 3 times, 81 complete games during that period. Still the best pitcher in the game and throwing cheese for that era. You know, really Nolan Ryan before Nolan Ryan. You'll hear Jeff Passan call him Walter Johnson. You know, the next Walter Johnson, a guy that threw really, really hard for his era. And his career starts to trail off a little bit in his late 20s into his 30s. I mean, he logged 30 starts a year still in his 30s, but he had already thrown 488 MLB innings before he turned 20. And then he averaged 283 innings per year in his 20s. That is just an insane workload on your arm and on your body. And he still had some good years in his 30s. 1951, he went 22-8, had a 3.5 ERA. But he just wasn't his normal self. Probably wasn't throwing as hard, body not moving the same. That workload just catches up with you. He ended his career 266 wins, 3,800 innings, 2,500 strikeouts, numbers that undoubtedly would have been much higher if he didn't miss four full seasons of his prime, which we'll touch on with Jeff Passan later in this episode. He pitched until he was 36, considering he started at age 17. It was an amazing career. And now that we have a little bit of background, let's go ahead and bring in our guest, Jeff Passan. All right, guys, we are back. And with that, I'm going to bring in Jeff Passan. Bob Feller. He was the first name you dropped months ago when I texted you about this podcast and you were saying, let's do Feller. And then we kind of went back and forth for a while and we ended up landing on Bob Feller, man. Why him?
It was kind of daunting, first off, to pick a guy here because you're talking with actual pitchers, people who have studied and appreciated the guys that they're talking about. And my instinct gravitates toward a guy who was born 60-something years before us and whose career was done like 25 years before I was born and like 35 years before you were born. And there's no video and there's no data except for this very, you know, weird way of trying to track how fast he was pitching. It's kind of a black box. And that was really intriguing to me because it's almost like with everything we know these days about pitchers, there's something romantic about corn-fed kid from Iowa who just slings shit. Yeah. And that's what Bob Feller did. Bob Feller was called the heater from Van Meter. He was from a tiny little town in Iowa, you know, signed at an extraordinarily young age and pitched in the big leagues then. And Strip, think about this. If a 17-year-old came to the big leagues these days, he would get destroyed. I don't care how good he is. He would get absolutely thumped. And Bob Feller went and like punched out, you know, what was it? 16, 17 guys in his debut?
17 as a 17-year-old. Only guy that ever has punched out his age. Kerry Wood was the other.
That right there tells you this was a phenom, but it wasn't a phenom like we see now. Who's the closest thing we've seen to a phenom pitcher in baseball? Only one person comes to mind for me, and I'm curious if you think the same thing.
I mean, Fernando Valenzuela from my time in LA seemed to be considered a phenom at a young age. I don't know if that's where you were going.
It's not. I was going Strasburg.
Okay, yeah.
I felt like when Strasburg came up, it was a thing. And I remember I went to that game. I think he punched out like 14 Pirates in seven innings that night. And it was like, holy shit, what have we got here? But
he was out of college still 20. He would have been 22 years old, right?
Yeah, I think he was 22. But you see, you know, Tatis coming up at 20 and you see Wander Franco hitting this absolute tank in spring training. And he's the next guy and Vladdy Jr. and Ronald Acuna. And it just seems like with position players, Bryce Harper, there are guys who year after year come up and they're supposed to be the next big thing. With pitchers, you don't see that very much. And the fact that Bob Feller was unequivocally that guy and was that guy in a time when, you know, there were a lot of great pitchers, I think it speaks to who he was and just what kind of a career he wound up having.
Yeah, good point. Well, let's jump into that career. You know, we covered this era at length on the Warren Spahn podcast. I did it with Alex Wood, Jeff, and it was a good time because you just feel nostalgic about this era of baseball when you start studying it and watching video, the jerseys, the windups, the stadiums, you know, just such a different feel from the game we see today. What sticks out to you the most when you study the video and the players from eras like the 30s, 40s, 50s?
At the risk of committing heresy here, what sticks out to me is that they kind of sucked compared to players these days. I have no doubt that if Willie Mays or Warren Spahn or Bob Feller were dropped into 2020 with their 1930s and 40s and 50s tools, and you gave them a year to train up using the things that we have right now, they'd be just as good as players are now. I don't think that the physical abilities of human beings have evolved to the point where things are all that much different than they were back then. But the training tools and the methods of learning how to excel simply were not the same then. And so the game was a lot slower. The swings were slower. The pitches were certainly slower. And it's part of what made Bob Feller as effective as he was and what made Walter Johnson the kind of guy he was. They threw really freaking hard, despite not training the way that guys do now. That's even something that's changed since I started covering ball in 2004. Back then, the thought that you could learn velocity really wasn't much of a thing.
Yeah.
It's like you were given what you were given, and maybe you can add a mile or two here or there, but the idea of weighted balls and velo training and jumping from 92 to 98, it was just a foreign concept. Well, Bob Feller came up throwing 98, and he was a bright, shining star. I think because he threw as hard as he did, probably ended up fizzling out as early as he did.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit. And, you know, all the stuff you just touched on is certainly the massive difference between the game then and now, and specifically to starting pitching. Just the idea that a starter would get the ball and you're going to go nine innings, or you're going to go until like shit really hit the fan, right? Like, even Bob Feller's last game was in 1956, bro. He went nine innings. He gave up 14 hits, eight runs, and took the L, but he went nine innings. I mean, just could not be more of a different philosophy from how a pitching rotation and a staff is managed in today's game.
Bob Feller started 484 games in his career and had CGs in 279 of them. The thing that stands out most to me is, you know, you can look at his innings totals, like the three largest inning totals of his career, 371.1, 343, 320. But Bob Feller punched out dudes and he walked a lot of guys. And what that ended up leading to were these obscene totals of batters faced. Now, I did a little bit of research. I didn't want to come into this completely unprepared. The last pitcher to go over 1,000 batters faced in a season was David Price in 2014. The last one before that was Felix Hernandez in 2010. In the last 5 years, the most batters faced in a season, Price had a year with 951, Madison Bumgarner 912, and Trevor Bauer in 2019 faced 911 guys. Let me give you the total batters faced in Feller's. I think this is probably, let's see, 9 best seasons, going from reverse order: 1,055, 1,061, 1,186, 1,218, 1,243, 1,248, 1,304, 1,466, 1,512. 1,512 batters in one season, Strip. What's the most you faced in one season?
Yeah, I was going to ask you. That might be more than I've faced in my career.
That's almost. You faced 1,816 batters over a good 5-year big league career.
That is outrageous to hear a stat like that, man.
In one season. And here's the thing. It wasn't like Bob Feller was one of these shit ball right-handers who was throwing like 82 and wasn't going max effort, because he was different, because he was Walter Johnson reborn.
Yeah, I said in the intro, is Nolan Ryan before Nolan Ryan. So you wrote a book called The Arm. For those that haven't read it, haven't seen it, please go check it out. I wanted to bring this up simply for the fact that I trust your opinion on pitching and all things arm. You wrote a book about it. I mean, my gosh. So at 18 years old, when I read this, dude, I thought it was so funny. At 18 years old, Bob Feller hurts his arm, goes in and asks the trainer, hey, you know, my elbow's kind of hurting. They diagnosed him with a dislocated ulna bone, you know, which is basically your, you know, right where your Tommy John runs over your ulna bone, connects your ulna collateral ligament. And I love this. The trainer gave Feller's arm a, quote, sudden twist and pronounced him ready to pitch after 1 day's rest. 2 days later, he threw a bullpen pain-free. I mean, that's revolutionary. Why don't we have that kind of stuff in today's game? I mean, what do you think that was? I mean, what, in reality, you know, you look at Sandy Koufax and Bob Feller, you know, obviously had a really long career, but was cut short in his 30s. These guys were probably getting hurt in ways that we see today that obviously you have much better medical attention and that kind of stuff. But like, I gave his arm a sudden a twist and 2 days later he pitched with no pain. Like, what do you think was going on there?
That's how medicine used to be before MRIs and before we really understood how the body operated and what biomechanics were. I mean, let's remember, Tommy John surgery didn't happen until 1974. So the idea that the ulnar collateral ligament could tear, well, if it did, you were either done or you did it like Nolan Ryan and you just pitched right through it. And some guys, whether it's because of their pain threshold, whether it's because of the musculature, whether it's because of their biomechanics, are able to do that. I mean, Masahiro Tanaka's UCL has been torn for a long time and he's just able to pitch through it. With Feller, though, it was an interesting category of medicine. It's almost like chiropractic, except for the body, as opposed to like the spinal area. And in the book, I talk about a guy, his name was John Rhys. And John Rhys was a Welsh immigrant, came to Pittsburgh originally and ended up in Youngstown. And he was a steel worker whose hands were believed to be magical. John Rhys had a nickname and he was called the Bone Setter. And his job was to take athletes as well as other people, you know, he prided himself on working on people rich and poor, was to take people who were in pain and essentially realign them. He had some dudes. It wasn't just like random people going to him. Rogers Hornsby saw the Bone Setter. Cy Young saw the Bone Setter. Ty Cobb, Walter Johnson, Hannes Wagner, all of these guys trusted this dude with their lives and livelihoods. And my favorite Bone Setter Rhys story was somebody, you know, saw that he's really good at this and like, you gotta get out the factory. You can't be rolling steel anymore. You gotta be rolling people's bodies. We're gonna send you to med school at Case Western Reserve, which is a college in Cleveland. So Bone Setter goes to med school for 3 weeks. And then he's like, nah, fuck this. I don't need med school. I'm just going to go crack people's bones. And people swore by the guy. They, you know, he had no training. They called him, like in his obituary, they call him doctor in quotes because everyone thought he was like a doctor, but there was no medical degree or anything like that. And so what Bob Feller did in that time was go to a Bone Setter and they twisted and thank God it worked, because if they had twisted in the wrong direction or if things had gone awry, who knows if he would have had a career at all.
Right. He's only 18 years old. And what a story, dude. The Bone Setter. That's crazy. That guy needs a movie. You think about guys from this era, you think World War II, you know, Warren Spahn and obviously Bob Feller, a mixture of guys that went and served our country. And they come back and they keep playing and have amazing careers. You know, Bob Feller certainly would have gotten to 300 wins, probably closer to 350 if it wasn't for his 4 years he missed in World War II. Let's say in a world he stays and he plays those 4 extra years in his prime and he gets to 350 wins. Where do you think he is on like the all-time list of pitchers then? You know, because he doesn't have 300 wins and that's still kind of a major accolade that you look at. Obviously, he's a Hall of Famer, you know, but Warren Spahn also went to World War II and he had 363 wins. So like, if he was able to get those 75 more, you know, would he be in the conversation of best of all time, or is he always kind of just one echelon below to you?
Is it wrong that I have him above Warren Spahn?
No, dude, I've never studied either one until this podcast. So I have him neck and neck too.
Yeah, I feel like Warren Spahn is more of a longevity guy and Bob Feller is more of a, you know, like best of the best. Don't get me wrong. Longevity is incredibly important and valuable, and Warren Spahn is definitely among the 25 best pitchers of all time. But I look at Feller and I look at Sandy Koufax as being very similar in that they had these incredible dominant years where they were just the unrivaled elite in the sport. And you look at, you know, you look at some of the MVP voting that Bob Feller was in. He never won an MVP award, but the names that he's near there, they're the best of all time. So I'd never done this before. The top tier guys, I had 12 of them. Feller was in there. I've got Feller, Pete Alexander, Christy Mathewson, Bob Gibson, Tom Seaver, Roger Clemens, Sandy Koufax, Pedro Martinez, Randy Johnson, Greg Maddux, Cy Young, and Walter Johnson. And the next tier, Spahn, Jim Palmer, Max Scherzer, Lefty Grove, Clayton Kershaw, Steve Carlton, Nolan Ryan, Eddie Plank. I'm sure you could take those guys in the second tier and make a good argument for them over some of the guys in the first tier, whether it's because of Koufax's lack of longevity, because it's Feller really, he didn't peter out at 28, but Feller pre-28 and Feller post-28 were different animals. I mean, you talk about missing prime years. I mean, he missed his ages 23, 24, 25, and most of 26 season. Right. Like for a pitcher, for a live-armed pitcher, that's when you're at your best. And he was coming off of back-to-back-to-back years where he was putting up numbers that were just unseemly. I mean, the kind of performance that Bob Feller was turning in, if we want to just look at it from strictly a wins above replacement perspective from Baseball Reference, his age 20 season, 9.2, 21, 9.9. And then he comes back from the WAR in his first full season, comes out and puts up a 370 inning, 10 win season. Yeah. I mean, the guy was an absolute marvel.
The bulk stats from those guys back then just get more and more impressive the more you see them, because our game is getting farther and farther away from that version of starting pitching. So you touched on it earlier, the legendary fastball, Walter Johnson, Nolan Ryan before Nolan Ryan. And you read these stats, you know, once clocked at 98.6 miles an hour, but that was registered at home plate, not out of the hand. So using modern tracking standards, they said that would be close to 107 miles an hour by some estimates. I mean, I'm calling bullshit, you know, but you watch him pitch, you know, you watch some guys from that era pitch and you're like, all right, that guy's pitching at like 85% effort. He's probably got to throw again in 2 days. Bob Feller, man, it looked balls to the wall every time he threw the ball.
And it was almost like he was something of a modern relief pitcher because he was just a two-pitch guy, you know? He wasn't coming in there with a changeup. He had fastball and he had a curveball and you couldn't touch his fastball. And then when you thought you were trying to cheat on the fastball, he'd spin in a curveball. And the fastball, though, listen, we're never going to know how hard Bob Feller was throwing. But I bet he threw 100 miles per hour. I bet he was just one of those unicorns at the time. Guys whose arms are absolutely blessed and whose bodies move in an efficient enough way to make a baseball do wondrous things. And the truth is, 100 miles per hour these days is
the norm, dude.
How many guys have you seen this spring who throw 100?
A lot, right? I mean, every spring there's a kid with an 87 on his back throwing 100.
That's exactly what it is. And I mean, they're like, and then there's Nate Pearson.
Oh, yeah. That's a 104. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, he's absurd. Like Bob Feller, though, it's not like he was a big dude. He was 6 foot tall, 185 pounds. Like
Bueller-esque, you know, he was probably more elastic than powerful.
Yeah. Like Pedro, too. You know, I see Bueller as being a little bit different. I feel like Bueller is such an efficient machine, whereas Pedro was not your classic, beautiful mechanics. You watch Walker Bueller pitch, that's kind of how you want to teach a guy to throw, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course.
I don't think you want to teach someone to throw like Bob Feller. It wasn't quite like Walter Johnson, you know, just arm out and just coming in and slinging it from the side. But there was a lot of looseness to it. And you wonder what sort of effect that had on how long his career did wind up lasting.
So I touched on it earlier. You requested Bob Feller, and I know that's because you're a Cleveland guy. Obviously, Feller spent his whole career with the Cleveland Indians, you know, in an era when guys could start with one team and make it all the way through. We did Smoltz and Maddux on this podcast too. Think about how long those guys spent with the Braves. You know, you don't necessarily see that as much in today's game, but you still have the Kershaws that are, you know, now in his 14th season as a Dodger. Anyways, Cleveland guy, you wanted Bob Feller. Did you get to know him as a man, like later in his life? Did you, you know, go to some old timers games in Cleveland and that's where you'd see him? Like, where did the passion for Bob Feller come from?
A few Bob Feller stories. I just grabbed a baseball here. And if you're looking at Zoom, what does that say on it?
Does it say Bob Feller?
It does say Bob Feller. Bob Feller's a guy who, if he were around today, would be canceled so hard. I mean, I'm serious. Like Bob Feller, it happened in 2005. There was a radio interview and he was talking about how Caribbean players don't know anything. He did an interview in 2005 with Frank DeFord for a really big story in Sports Illustrated. And let me read you a quote. It's Bob Feller Day at the Indian Spring Training Camp. Little figurines, which are graced by the garish logo of the Best Western hotel chain, and which otherwise portray a youthful Rapid Robert in wind-up mode, have been awarded to those in attendance. El Cheapo is the assessment of the figurine model himself. Nothing like my bobblehead from a few years ago, Feller said, but what do you expect? Made by some ping pong player in China.
Oh, man. Can't do that.
Bob Feller did this all the time. And when I talked to him, you know, I talked to him once, maybe twice for stories. And I had this happen with another old athlete too, Chuck Bednarik, who like Bob has passed. And Chuck Bednarik, the first time that I called him, it was my first job in Fresno, California. And I asked Chuck Bednarik, I was doing a story on two-way football players. And Chuck Bednarik in that conversation talked about players doing jigaboo dances. Oh, and I was like, what the hell is, like, I wasn't sure if I heard it right. And it's interesting to try and reconcile this with what should old people be allowed to get away with? Like, how do you convince someone like Bob Feller, who believes that his worldview is correct, is impervious, and knowing that there are tons of other people out there like Bob Feller, how do you reconcile the man's brilliance with what obviously were his flaws, deep flaws, and flaws that he refused to listen on? If you tried to tell Bob Feller that what he said there about someone from China was racist and was wrong, he would get pissed and he would call you PC. And that would be his excuse. And so I've had this very weird relationship with Bob Feller in my head, trying to appreciate the brilliance, but also looking at some of these things that he stood for and that he believed in and having a difficult time understanding it. And I was glad that I read that Frank DeFord story, because all these years I've thought that this was a Bob Feller autograph. But in the story, it says Bob Feller refused to sign in black ink. He would only sign in blue ink because blue represented the American League and black was the color of the National League. And he hated the National League because that's how things used to be before free agency. And, you know, back when Cleveland was part of the American League royalty. And so I'm pretty sure that this autograph that I've thought I've had forever from Bob Feller is not real.
No way. That's crazy. And just because you happen to read a story and you had that ball and now you look at it and you're like, that's probably not real. That is wild.
I wish that stuff about Bob Feller weren't true, but it is.
Yeah.
He said it. He believed it. We can look back and say that this is a man who served valiantly. I mean, the day after Pearl Harbor, he enlisted. Like, this is someone who did heroic things for the country. And he didn't go around touring and playing baseball. He was on missions. He was a real soldier. This was someone who did great, great things. But he also did some things throughout his life and had some opinions that didn't square with some of his actions. You know, Bob Feller was the first Hall of Famer to really push for Negro Leagues players to be inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it doesn't really go hand in hand with what you just said, though, does it?
No. It's and it's why it's part of the confusing nature of his legacy. It's part of wondering the question, can good-natured people think bad things and not be willing to learn? And that is a flaw. But is that something that, you know, takes Bob Feller and puts him in the disqualification pile? And how, as a society, do we look at people who grew up in different times than ours, with less education, on systemic racism, and on some of the things that really are problematic in our society. And because they're old and because they are unwilling to learn, do they get a pass on that? Or do we look at them in a completely different way?
Well said, man. You know, I'm glad we went there because it's part of his history and part of his, you know, legacy in the game. So that has to be covered on this podcast. It's part of it. Let's go ahead and move on into what we finish every podcast with, which is, would he be good in today's era? And obviously the game is so different. The product on the field really couldn't be more different than the era that Bob Feller played. But what's fun is we talk about this in the locker room all the time. Like, would Babe Ruth be any good today? Ted Williams, these guys, you know, and we were talking about Warren Spahn with Alex Wood, and he waited till after we stopped the interview to bring this up when he said, you know, what's cool is 40 years from now, we'll be able to still have these analytics. Like Kershaw, we'll know what Kershaw's spin rate was, his horizontal and vertical movement. So we could still have that in 40 years and be able to like really say, you know, the best lefty of 2060 had a pretty similar analytical line as a Clayton Kershaw in 2020. So that's cool, but we don't have that with Bob Feller. What do you think, man? You think he'd be good in today's game?
You know, they didn't start naming Cy Youngs until 1956. So the way to look at where Bob Feller was in MVP voting. He finished third in 1938. He was behind Joe DiMaggio and Jimmy Fox. He finished second in 1939 behind Hank Greenberg. He finished third in 1940 behind Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams. Baseball remains baseball, right? If you drop 1946 Bob Feller into today, probably a decent relief pitcher. Maybe a guy who, because he can go a long time and, you know, can throw complete games, is effective. But he walks way more guys than anyone these days does. And I think hitters these days are just better. Like, they are more patient. They hit the ball harder. They hit the ball farther. We do this ESPN Sports Science thing. You know, Vic Wertz hit the ball in the 1954 World Series, and Willie Mays goes out and makes the catch. And the sports science people estimated that the exit velo on Vic Wertz's smash into center field was 106.8 miles per hour. We see that every day. Right. Like, we see that all the time now.
Yep.
And so I think that Bob Feller, if you give him some of the training now, would be absolutely elite. But if you just drop 1940s Bob Feller into right now, he's just a guy.
Yeah, spot on, man. Well said all the way through the podcast. You came in prepared like I knew you would. And Bob Feller's in this era in general is just so fun to talk about, man. I mean, he pitched to Lou Gehrig, Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio. That's pretty damn cool, you know, when you can sit back and talk about a guy like that for a half hour. Jeff Passan, everyone, check him out on ESPN, Twitter. He's always breaking big news in baseball. Jeff, man, as always, I'm going to walk away from this conversation with a smile on my face because you're just a blast to have around, man. Thanks for taking the time. This was Bob Feller, Jeff Passan. Thank you, man.
Thanks, Tripp.